Our next case up and last case of the day, Bank America versus Farrell Street Trust, 70299. Mr. Stern, if you're ready.
Good afternoon, Justices. This is Ariel Stern, appearing on behalf of Bank of America and Recon Trust Company. We ask in this appeal for this court to reverse the district court on two bases. One is that the pre-sale payment of the super priority component of the lien redeemed that lien, leaving the homeowner association with only a sub-priority lien to foreclose. The district court committed an error of law when it denied the consequence of Bank of America's pre-sale payment. Separately and independently from that, the district court committed an error of law in determining that there is no such thing as commercial reasonableness that can apply at all in a homeowner association sale. Each one of these errors would justify a reversal. And in the case of the first error, the denial of the consequence of the pre-sale payment, we believe that the court should reverse with instruction to the district court to enter judgment on behalf of Bank of America.
So, I'm confused about the timing, okay? In 2009, you make a tender, and it's a cashier's check, unlike many of the tenders that we've had. So it looks like they argue that it's not perfect tender, but let's say it's a perfect tender of the 9 months. That was due in 2009. They then withdraw that and issue a new notice of default, and there's no renewed tender in opposition to that. And I can't tell from the record. It's very frustrating. I can't tell whether the amounts for the 2010 notice of default include the same 9 months of default that would have been in the first one. Are you following me?
I am following Justice Spector. I mean, I was equally frustrated last night trying to piece this together, and I anticipated the question. And I think we have an answer. There are, and in fact, I have a little chronology here that may be helpful to you as well. There is a first lien that's recorded. By first lien, I don't mean in terms of priority. I mean chronologically in 2009.
Right.
There is, following that, on our timeline, in November of 2009, a notice of default. The notice of lien, you can find at page 147 of the record. The notice of default, that's at page 249.
You say that is what date?
The notice of lien was on October 6, 2009, the first in time, chronologically the first notice of lien. It was followed by a notice of default, which was executed on November 20th, 2009, and for some reason not recorded until January of 2010.
Yeah, I have January 4th, 2010.
That's the date of recordation. It was actually executed in November. You'll see that most of these documents were dated and executed and recorded
late. I just want to make sure we're on the same.
I think we're talking about the same document. Chronologically, then, the bank receives the notice of default that was recorded in January of 2010 and requests the super priority component of the lien from Alessi and Koenig. That's on sometime in April of 2010.
You're told it's $50 a quarter.
And that's when Alessi gives a statement on the facts is dated April the 14th of 2010, and that's what says it's $50 a quarter. Bank of America pays that on May 11th of 2010. Then there is
do they cash your check? You send a letter with a cashier's check. My notes say May 10th, 2010.
Correct, Your Honor. That's on May 10th. Well, my notes had May 11th.
But it's the same thing.
Yes.
Do they keep your money or do they give it back?
Your Honor, I think at that point they give it back.
Okay.
I shouldn't say I think. At that point, they give it back.
Okay, so they reject it. You say it's a perfect tender. They say it's not. But let's call it a perfect tender.
We need to make sure who's they. As the record, as you have it before you, doesn't have any statement from the Homeowner Association or a lessee in Conning as to why they reject that. That's Feral Trust who's saying that, and it's speculative on their part, and it didn't really factor into the district court's order.
Okay, so we don't have firsthand knowledge. Okay.
And it wasn't a factor for the district court's order either. And so we're a little bit limited, but as we piece this picture together, the next chronological entry here is on June 30th, 2010, less than 2 months after the pre-sale payment. And that's when a second notice of lien is recorded. Excuse me. It's executed on June 30th. It's recorded on July 22nd of 2010.
Yep, I'm with you.
Okay. So
does that include the same amounts that were included in the one that was recorded January 4th?
The answer is not clear from the record. It was not developed factually by the district court. However, Justice Pickering, we believe that nagging question of fact does not affect what relief we asked for here, which was a reversal with instruction, because the Homeowner Association has 9 months of super priority starting from the date of the commencement of foreclosure going back 9 months. So if we assume that the 9 months here are triggered on the second notice of lien, the one that was reported in July of 2010, we would have to be going back 9 months from that date. And when Bank of America tendered the payment in May of 2010, only a month prior, it tendered $150, which would have covered what would have been owed for the nine-month period preceding July of 2010. And so it was a perfect tender. Now, I'd like to make another point, Your Honor.
Wait a second, though, because wouldn't it have been when they did the notice of default in 2009, there were already 9 months accrued? And this was tendered with reference to that one.
Well, there's a little bit of a... I think the answer to that is no.
Okay.
If you look at the notice of lien that was reported in 2009, and this is on page 147 of your record, it describes what was owed. And this is according to Leslie and Conan's own description what was owed. It says, the total amount through today's date is $584.50, and of this total, $494.50 represents collection and our attorney's fees, and $90 represents collection costs, fees, services charge, and interest. According to the first notice, I believe there wasn't a penny owed in assessments.
Okay, and what's the record site for that, please?
That is page 147 of the record.
Okay, thank you.
So according to the initial notice of lien, there wasn't any assessment owed. Mm-hmm. Now, if you look at the notice of lien that's recorded in July of 2010, that does have more expansive language that says that part of what's owed is assessments. The second notice of lien you would find on page 249 of the record. It's difficult to make, to piece together concrete assumptions from this or concrete conclusions, but I think, Justice Pickering, that the amount that's claimed in July of 2010 is $869. That compares to $1,635 that was set as owed on July 14th, 2010, which when Alessi and Koenig made provided the ledger to Bank of America. So from that point, if we're going to make conclusions, or I should say inferences from this evidence, it looks like the amount that was owed decreased from $1,635 to $869, which would not have been enough, I don't think, based on the $50 per month, $50 per quarter assessment, would have been enough for us to really conclude that the first lien was paid off in its entirety. So I think the most likely thing here is that there is overlap between the amount claimed and the July of 2010 notice of lien and the April 2010 ledger. I think there's overlap there, but regardless of how that pans out factually, and again, the district court did not turn that factually for reasons that I'd like to address in a minute. However that is accounted for, Justice Pickering, one thing is undisputed. In July of 2010, if you count back 9 months, the maximum amount of the super priority lien would have been $150, and that's what Bank of America paid in May of 2010, only 2 months later.
Two months earlier.
Thank you. Yes, 2 months earlier. And so We're not sure exactly why a lessee accounted things the way they did or why they recorded a second notice of lien. I think we can...
And then they later withdraw the first one.
And then a year later, in 2011, yeah. they withdrew the first one. The timing here is it raises a lot of question marks. And 2 points on that. One is I don't think any of those question marks really affect the central issue here. Again, the correct amount was tendered prior to the sale. And it was
and you're
done.
Not contending, though, that if in 2005 they went into default and they tendered and then it was paid and it went forward, that they couldn't put you in default again and take another 9 months. That's not your argument, right?
Not for this case, Your Honor.
Okay.
So for this case, we're not saying that you get what
one
we call the evergreen,
yeah.
that you get 1 9-month priority. I think
okay.
for this case, we can make the assumption.
You're saying you don't have to do that for this case?
I think for this case, you can make the assumption that you have to pay, basically it resets and you have to pay if there's a second notice of lien.
Assuming it covers a different period, that the previous one's been satisfied.
Correct, Your Honor. I think in this case, there's an overlap.
Faith either. You can't just serially keep doing it.
I don't think so. I don't think that's happened in a whole lot of cases. Mm-hmm. I think in this case, to me, it's clear that there's an overlap. To the extent that there's lack of clarity, I remind this court, and I think the district court lost sight of that, is that all inferences are made in favor of the non-moving party in summary judgment. What the district court did here was basically determine that we made the pre-sale payment without really making any finding as to whether LSE or the HOA or both of them or neither one of them was behind the rejection or why the rejection was made. It basically said that the bank needed to take, in its statement, more steps, needed to do more without specifying what else had to be done.
So are you asking us to reverse and render in your favor, or are you asking us to reverse and remand for further proceedings?
We're asking you to reverse and render in our favor, Your Honor. We believe that based on, we had our own counter
yeah.
motion for summary judgment, and we believe that based on the tender, which was for the correct amount, and which was on, we believe, one lien, and we remind the court that this is the plaintiff's burden as the plaintiff to show that that's not the case. But the record here, I think, shows pretty clearly that it was. We would ask the court to reverse with instruction to enter judgment in favor of the bank. And
Mr. Stern, can I just clarify a couple of things?
Mm-hmm.
Is it undisputed fact between the parties that the quarterly dues are $50, so therefore three quarters is $150? Your client tendered $150 by cashier's check before the sale date. It was rejected, and go from there. I mean, are those facts, as far as you know, not in dispute?
As far as I know, Justice Gibbons, they're not only not in dispute between the parties. The district court, I don't think, disputed those either. I think the district court's rationale was that once the homeowner association rejected the payment, that the bank had to do more without specifying what those additional steps were, even though SFR Investment says that the bank has to pay, and that's what we did, even though...
Well, we've answered the question on what the bank has to pay, you know, subsidy.
And I can hold things. You have, Justice Gibbons. I think what the district court concluded was that the burden is on the bank to do more than the law requires. That the bank paid, is the homeowner association voluntarily, for reasons of their own, which are not in the record, declined the payment. But having done that, our position is, as this court already held in the Stone Hollow case, that satisfied the super priority one.
Can I ask you a question, though, about your letter on the transmittal on perfect tender?
Mm-hmm.
Says, it's on page 246 of your record, this is a non-negotiable amount. Any endorsement, whether expressed or implied, will be strictly construed, and then this is the language that gave me a bit of pause. As an unconditional acceptance on your part of the facts stated herein, an express agreement that BAC's financial obligations towards the HOA in regards to the real property located at so-and-so have now been paid in full. Does that contemplate that you're taking the legal position that once they take that $150, they could never lean against you for the 9 months, even in the case of a future default?
I don't think that
worried me a bit. Were you trying to put a condition that legally they only had one shot at the 9 months?
I don't think that's the case, Justice Pickering. I think we have to look at this in its totality.
Uh-huh.
This letter was written in response to the notice of sale.
Uh-huh.
And if we look Further in our record, you will see a more complete set of these tender documents. And that's starting on page 292.
Okay.
The page I'd like to direct your attention to is on page 296. This is the first communication from Miles Bauer, the bank's counsel, which requests the super priority amount from LS and Coney. And the letter says there's a reference line that says what it's about, and it says, "Dear sirs, this letter is in response to your notice of default with regard to the HOA assessments purportedly owed on the above described legal property." So I think the letter, which is the first communication, makes very clear that as you look at the entire context of the communication,
so that was what you were treating as the...
This specific notice is out.
Okay.
This specific notice of default. I see I have 5 seconds for rebuttal. I'd like to reserve that.
We're going to give you 2 minutes, Mr. Varner.
I appreciate that, Justice.
An additional 2 on his primary argument.
Good afternoon. Please the court. Michael Bone on behalf of the respondent, Farrell Street Trust.
Before you get too far into it, the last point that got raised in terms of the letter with the payment, did the court ever make any finding one way or the other as to that being a valid tender, so to speak, with the language that was in their letter? Or did the court just not say anything?
The district court didn't make a finding. The district court specifically made a finding that they tendered what they believed the proper amount was. That's specifically in the finding of fact and the conclusions of law. The important part of the order, however, is the fact that the bank didn't do anything after the tender was rejected to protect its interests. And that goes, I believe, to the availability of an equitable remedy.
But if you had a perfect tender, if you have a perfect tender in response to a demand in a foreclosure setting and you tender cash or immediately available funds with no inappropriate conditions, you can't go ahead with the foreclosure. It's not incumbent on the tenderer at that point to go to court. And I recognize Shadowood says they needed to go to court, but there was no perfect tender established in Shadowood. If you credit that this was a perfect tender, wouldn't that extinguish the lien as against the super priority holder or the super priority, the bank in this case? Wouldn't that extinguish it as to that claim?
Well, that's a very loaded question for a number of reasons. First of all, we're looking at it now after ICON has been decided.
Yes.
You go back to 2010, 2011, when the issue was still undecided, the authorities are, if there is a good faith basis for the rejection of the tender, because you believe more may be owed, then it's not a good tender and it doesn't discharge the debt. I'll also point out, if you look at the restatement, section 6.4, which talks about tender, I believe comment 5 to section G notes that as between the obligor and the obligee, if the tender is made, it discharges the debt and stops the running of interest and such. It goes on in the comments to point out that the theoretical satisfaction of a lien doesn't do any good in modern times when the lien is still a public record and not discharged. Now, Shadowood does talk about the rights.
Well, it does because it's not foreclosable if it's been tendered. It may continue of record and be the subject of a quiet title, but you can't foreclose an invalidated lien.
Well, again, the all the cases that have been cited in the brief.
Or a satisfied lien would be the more appropriate.
All the cases involving tender that I have seen, and we've done a lot of research on these both sides, they all involve the primary obligor and obligee. When you have a third party involved, because the bank is not the person primarily responsible for the lien, it is the homeowner who's primarily responsible for the lien. So you have a third party involved, then you have the fourth party, the purchaser at the HOA sale. And in Shadowwood, the court points out in the discussion of bona fide purchaser that there was no evidence that the purchaser at the sale there had any notice of the pre-sale attempt at tender or the dispute regarding the amount.
Well, let's back up. You made a point when you were going through and saying what we've learned, and you made this point that a good faith basis to reject the tender. Do we have one in this case? Anywhere in the record?
We have nothing in the record. We have nothing in the record as to
why. Why shouldn't we just send it back?
Because they didn't do anything to further protect their interest and not involve the interests of third parties.
If, in fact, they made a perfect tender, so to speak, or a tender that has not been objected to on any basis, why isn't that sufficient that they then have a right that needs to be enforced?
Again, they are not entitled to equitable relief because they knew the sale. First of all, this was on a prior lien. That lien was released. And Your Honor started out asking about what were the amounts. The original notice of lien in October 2009 was for $584.50. The first notice of default recorded January of 2010 was for $1,486. The second notice of lien, which was recorded 6 months later, July 2010, was for a lesser amount.
$869.32.
So,
those liens that you've just given us, based upon some questions we were asked of counsel before, if there were $50 a quarter and only 9 months is allowed, all those numbers, and I don't have to take off my shoes to do the math, are in excess of that.
Well, and those are fees and costs that would be added on, perhaps. You know, we only had the ledger that was available when the bank made the first inquiry. And
but wasn't this the amount of money that was given to them as what was due and owing as a lien?
No, a ledger was sent, but there was no representation that this amount will satisfy your super party lien. It was just a cover letter with a ledger. Mm-hmm. Now, I'd like the district court made a specific finding. They didn't do anything to protect their interests in the property. Shadowwood cites a number of cases that says that equitable relief is not available. If you know something's going to happen and the rights, and you let it happen, and the rights of third parties become affected.
But,
they knew
wait,
the tender.
But Shadowwood, there was expressly put in that opinion, and I know it, that the tender, the amounts were all confusing because of the bank became the owner of the property, and because the bank foreclosed its own deed of trust midway through. So you don't have exactly the same situation of a perfect tender. Did you dispute in district court whether this tender was on its face unconditional and in an appropriate amount?
Well, that's another issue, the conditional part of it. I'll point out that the inquiry letter that was sent, the one that is in the record, if you look at it on page 296, it's unsigned and it's dated February 4th, 2015. That's the letter that's in the record. It was obviously a copy that was made after the fact, and nobody went back to
296?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
But it's dated from 2015. And the check that was submitted was not a cashier's check. It was just a trust account check from the law firm of Miles Barrow. And if you look at the notation on the check, it says, to cure HOA deficiency. That would tend to imply that the entire lien was cured and not just the super priority portion. So when Banna says that they made a perfect tender, it was at best a confusing tender. And because it was a confusing tender, and the law was unsettled at the time, the standards for equitable relief, you're not entitled to equitable relief if you are on notice of an event that's going to affect third parties and you let it happen and the third parties get involved. If the tender was wrongfully rejected, then they have a claim for money damages against the party that wrongfully rejected it. And if they have a money damages remedy, then they don't have the right to an equitable remedy And that is very important here, because in all of these cases, and Your Honor, I'm sure you're aware there's a lot of them in the district court, and there's probably a lot before this court, and there's more coming, they're playing with nickels and dimes. In SFR, the court said, you can just pay the full amount and sue for a refund later. Instead, what they did in hundreds of cases was play gotcha. We sent you this, we're not going to say anything, we're not going to do anything, and we're going to come in and clog up the court. Literally, thousands of cases have been filed in the district court. And they're coming here asking for equity. In the meantime, purchasers such as my client went out and purchased, not knowing there was any dispute or there was even a tender made until after the lawsuit was filed. I'll also point out that virtually all the cases before SFR just went on the theory the case should be dismissed because the foreclosure doesn't extinguish the deed of trust. After SFR, that's when we came up with commercial unreasonableness, and well, that was mentioned in SFR, but the constitutional arguments and the tender arguments and some other
arguments. In this case, the district court actually reached and resolved that 116 incorporates 107090 for notice purposes, contrary to Gorn Valley.
Correct.
So that much is clear in this record that was raised and resolved. One of the frustrations for this court is if people want us to decide cases, you need to have a clear record that has evidence that's established. So the letter says there's a cashier's check. You're saying there was no cashier's check. There's a trust account check. I mean, that stuff's very difficult.
Well, if you look at the check, it's clearly not a cashier's check.
Okay, what's the record site for the check?
Page 247.
Well, what was it, Mr. Bowman, the check?
It's a check drawn on the account. Well, it says Miles Bauer, Bergstrom & Winters Trust Account.
Well, I guess more importantly, what did the district court say about the check, or was that even raised in the district court?
That wasn't raised in district court.
Well, we're not fact-finding. That's the problem that Justice Pickering is pointing out. So, you know, it's like, are we arguing apples and oranges, or what are we arguing? We have to be dependent upon the record made down below.
And this case was decided before Shadowwood, and I've seen a number of unpublished decisions.
It still does not change what we do and how we do it.
I understand that completely. But the point I am trying to make is they are not entitled to equitable relief. We can skip all these arguments, all these issues, because they didn't act to protect themselves before the sale. Equity requires that. You can't let third parties get involved. If the tender was wrongfully rejected, they have a claim against the party who wrongfully rejected it. That's an remedy of law.
Mr. Brown, I understand your point. I think it's a good point. I mean, we're just baffled by these banks sat around for years and didn't ask for injunctions before these foreclosures. It's just incredible that, you know, I'm sure if Mr. Stern was there representing the time, it would have been handled differently. But here, so it's kind of a Russian roulette going in here. I mean, you better have a perfect tender or you're dead. So the question is this a perfect tender or not? I think that's what it boils down to in this case. You know.
And again, the public policy, you know, had they paid the full amount and sued for a refund, the small claims courts that would be clogged with all these cases instead of the district courts, both state and federal, and this court also.
I'm sure Mr. Stern is going to go back and say, look, the $150 in hindsight was the perfect amount. We tendered it. It was risky, very risky, but we tendered it, and it was there, and therefore we satisfied the law and the super priority amount. What's your response to that?
Well, my response, Your Honor, is well, you have the right to pay the full amount in sue for a refund. And there's right. So many things they could have done differently. There's things they should have done differently. And as a matter of public policy, if you reverse and remand or leave the door open for them to get equitable relief when they're not entitled to it, you are encouraging poor business behavior. There were other things they could have done in this case and in every other case.
Well, they might say they're soothsayers, and they anticipated what the Supreme Court would do years down the road and calculating the amount of the super priority lien, and they just got lucky on this one. I mean,
business behavior is a two-way street, too. I mean, if I'm going to do a notice of default and I'll let you sell, and I send you the amount that's due, and you tender that, to me in full amount. I'm not entitled to go ahead with foreclosure sale against you.
And
that's valid.
Yeah, the court.
And I get that you say it's third parties and there's other sales and all like that. But it's a two-way street.
Well, again, my client is the innocent purchaser. The court made a specific finding that under the statutes 116, bona fide purchaser was not an issue. So I can't really make that argument.
We have no doubt your client's innocent because your client went in and just bought it a sale, which is fine. You can do. My question is this transaction even insurable? Could your client even get title insurance with the unsettled nature of the law at the time? You know, is he on notice because the trust on notice that if you can't get title insurance, there might be a problem here with it till everything's sorted out?
Well, again, Shadowwood points out six different factors as to why you can or cannot be a bona fide purchaser. The fact that one party may have the right to bring an equitable action to set the sale aside is not grounds to deprive him of the status of a bona fide purchaser. So the fact he can or get title insurance really is not an issue here. What facts was he on notice of?
Right.
Now, this court has cited the real estate finance law treatise, section 7.22 in Shadowwood, and Stone Hollow 3, Justice Pickering cited section 7.21. It's a different world with a bona fide purchaser with a voluntary conveyance as opposed to an involuntary conveyance. With a voluntary conveyance, you're taking the property subject to anything that's of record. With a foreclosure sale, however, when you have a strong lien, such as an HOA lien, it wipes out everything that's of record. So when the bank says, oh, you knew of our deed of trust, it doesn't matter. The sale wipes out the deed of trust. What the treatise says is you're a bona fide purchaser if, A, you don't have actual notice of a defect, B, it's not the kind of thing you're going to learn from the recorded notices, and C, it's not the kind of thing you're going to learn from the foreclosure sale. And in the Shadowwood case, the court said, if I may quote, when an association's foreclosure sale complies with the statutory foreclosure rules as evidenced by the recorded notice, such as the case here, without any facts to indicate to the contrary, the purchaser would only have noticed the former owner had the ability to raise equity-based post-sale challenge, the basis of which is unknown to that purchaser. My point, again, is when you're involving third persons, it's a different game altogether. The cases are legion. You don't affect the title of the bona fide purchaser or even the innocent purchaser. And that's one of the quotes in Shadowwood. You can't involve the rights of innocent third purchasers. And that's what the bank has done here. You know, I've cited extensively about the requirements to record something. That was one of the things that Shadowwood said you could have done. SFR said you could pay the full amount. Shadowwood said get an injunction, request arbitration, record a list pendant, do something. It's $17 to record something with the recorder's office. And how many millions of dollars in just fees have been damaged? Well,
you're right about that. That's for sure.
Thank you, Your
Honor. Mr. Stern, as you're getting up, was this or wasn't it a cashier's check?
It looks from the... I just looked at it. It looks like it was not a cashier's check, Your Honor, but it doesn't
mean... It's that problem. I mean...
It doesn't mean that it was an invalid tender or that it was not... that there were not funds behind it.
Well, I understand. You would think normally, I would have thought attorney's cashier's check would be gold until we do these bar discipline cases, and they write bad trust account checks like... you can't believe how often, you know.
I understand that. I don't think that that's ever been an issue with the Miles Power firm.
I'm sure it wasn't, but I mean...
I think anecdotally, not anecdotally, in trials, the people who worked at that firm said that they had somewhere over 5,000 cases. For Bank of America loan, and I'd like to address that right away, Justice Gibbons. You expressed your bafflement. I'd like to make clear that my client, in this case, Bank of America, knew that it had to pay. That's why it paid. It knew the correct amount because it read the statute, and the statute was clear. It was just as clear as the risk that there was a super priority lien, which was why Bank of America was the bank that, of all the major services, was actually paying. And so I'd like to make sure that the court understands that while there were many different players in this industry. The Bank of America and Bank of America's cases are going to present this factual scenario where a payment was made. And So in answer to your question is the bank did try and get an injunction twice, once in federal court, once in state court. The federal case was dismissed to go to under mediation. After under mediation, it was filed in state court. None of that is in this record. I think in future cases, we'll make sure that that's part of the
okay,
record.
Okay, so it's not in this record, but you're representing as an officer. They did seek to get an injunction before
yes.
the...
Yes, and the lawyers in this courtroom know about that because I was involved in that.
Okay, case. Well, we can't consider if it's on the record. I
concede that to you, but you mentioned your puzzlement, and I wanted to make sure that you understand that there's more to the story than just, you know, the banks are doing nothing. In this case, Farrell Street asks for equity and says this is all about equity. It is not. As a matter of law, the tender redeems. This is not equity.
With that, this case stands submitted.